Last week, we brought you the IUL, taxes, loans, and flexibility of the Index Universal Life product. Today, we're going to be talking whole life. Same thing, we're going to dive into the taxes, the loans, and the flexibility of whole life. You don't have to listen to any of our other episodes to be able to understand what we're going to be going over today. If you're interested in whole life, stick around. This is the Life Insurance Financial Education Podcast, where we're pulling back the curtain on high cash value life insurance and how it can help you build wealth and achieve your financial goals. I'm your host, James Barber, your Oregon cash flow pro.
And my name is Carlo Vaccaro with NetWealth Finance.
All right, Carlo, today we're talking whole life. What can you tell me about some of the tax advantages of that product?
So there are a number of regulations that people will cite. I'm not going to get into the specifics of all of what those are, but one of the reasons for those regulations being put in place was in the 70s and 80s, people were using life insurance as a tax shelter. And so that's one of the biggest advantages of it. We can have the ability to borrow against our policies, have compounding growth at the same time, and this can be a fantastic tool for growing wealth while still building wealth elsewhere. And that is through those policy loans. So what people were doing was stuffing a whole bunch of cash into these policies because some of these limits with the concept of a MEC or a modified endowment contract just were not in play. And it was a bit of a Wild West situation. And since then, now things are a little bit more normal. It is a great tax strategy, but it's not what it was in the 1970s or 80s.
Way back then, there was like 1 or 2 years where people figured out that they could pay for like $100,000 in death benefit and just dump millions into a policy and get in this tax sheltered environment. And the government figured out pretty quick, that's not going to work anymore. Let's regulate that better. Now, we do still have plenty of tax advantages, though, in life insurance. And whole life, no different as far as most of the tax advantages that we get from all of our other life insurance products. But that tax, that death benefit, tax-free, as long as you meet certain qualifications, which is like most of the things that people do when they own these products, that death benefit is going to be tax-free. But there can be some circumstances where it doesn't end up tax-free. Should we touch on those right now?
Yeah, I think I briefly mentioned it. There is that concept of modified endowment contract where the tax treatment is a little bit different, although the death benefit still passes income tax-free. Some of the use in your lifetime may not have those same tax advantages. Another way is if you do something with your business where you're deducting that premium paid. Maybe you have key person insurance. If you're deducting that premium, then that death benefit that might be used to buy out your business partner, that is not going to be tax-free. So there's probably some other scenarios too, but I think that's probably one of the biggest ones that people might run into.
One of the major ones that a lot of people don't talk about much is what's known as the Goodman Triangle. You want to make sure that at least 2 out of these 3 are the same people, the owner, the insured, or the beneficiary. If they're not, if all 3 of those are different people or entities, you could be in some type of violation with the IRS that will cause that death benefit to not be tax-free also. So that's the Goodman Triangle. We're going to discuss that in a future podcast at some point, but look that up if you're interested in a little bit more information regarding that. Beyond the death benefit, we've got incredible tax advantages for the growth that's going to happen inside of these policies and how we access that cash value that we're going to grow in these high cash value whole life policies.
The way that we access in whole life, if we're going to access the funds during our lifetime, and maybe we want to use it for something like supplementing retirement income. With whole life, it's generally going to be preferred for you to withdraw up to your tax basis. Now, what does that mean? Well, you can withdraw all of the premiums paid in, and that will come out tax-free. And then after that, you can transition to loans if you do need more funds. So oftentimes, People might draw some bit of retirement income using that. And maybe that becomes a bridge to get you to where you want to supplement before you get your Social Security. And then after you withdraw all your basis, maybe you don't even start taking loans. But you do have that option if you do need to supplement your income a bit more.
Yeah, so we get that access to the cash. It's going to grow tax deferred in the meantime. If we do access more than our basis, if we withdraw more than that, we are going to get hit with income taxes. That's an important thing to know. It's not gains. It's taxed on the gains, but it's not a capital gains tax. It is going to be income tax in this scenario. So really important to have a plan if you get to that position that you're going to do loans instead. And that's really what we deal with all of our clients is we're going to be talking about distributions in retirement potentially, or using this product as some type of a volatility buffer against other investments, generally in retirement. And the main goal is let's avoid those taxes.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really good point as well. If let's just say retirement age is hitting your portfolio, you know, you plan for your 4% rule with your normal asset portfolio, your investments, but the market takes a little bit of a hit. Whole life can step in. You withdraw up to your basis to supplement those years, let that recover. You don't want to sell on those down years because that can really, that sequence of returns factor is real. And so whole life can be a really great place for that.
Absolutely. Okay, let's discuss MEC limits. You mentioned it a bit, but in general, your life insurance policy is treated, the money you put into it, on a first in, first out basis. That's one of the tax advantages and why we draw that tax basis out first as withdrawals before we shift to loans. However, if we have a modified endowment contract, that's a life insurance policy that somebody's put too much money into it too quickly. It violated the guidelines. It's now considered a modified endowment contract by the IRS. We no longer get first in, first out treatment on those funds. What do they call it?
Last in, first out.
Last in, first out. That's right. You're going to get taxed on the money that comes out first as if it's just the gains. And it's still going to be income tax. And it's not only if you do a withdrawal.
Yes. So if you're doing loans, you are going to be paying taxes on that. So this is really, generally speaking, if you trigger a MEC in a policy, it is not conducive to doing infinite banking any longer at that point. So there are reasons that people might use MECs for different reasons, but that is not for the purpose of being your bank. You lose a lot of those during your lifetime benefits.
Yeah, it's important to understand the different tax consequences of a policy, if it's a MEC or not a MEC, especially if you're planning on using it for doing infinite banking, which we talk about constantly on this channel. Very, very important. So I think that covers the tax portion of whole life pretty good. What are the different types of loans available out there?
At a high level, the loans that we'll get into are classified into kind of two buckets, direct recognition and non-direct recognition loans. So these factually mean, does the insurance company care whether or not you have a loan out, and does that impact the dividend? So a direct recognition loan means it will impact the dividend in some way, and a non-direct recognition loan means that they don't care. It doesn't matter. It makes no difference to their crediting of your policy. So, and each of these can have their advantages and disadvantages. It's not one's better than the other. Many in this space might say only find the non-direct recognition, but my own policy is a direct recognition policy, and I am very happy with it.
I think agents do tend to get some type of a preference for one or the other. What we see right now in the non-direct recognition space, a couple of the major carriers that get used for infinite banking or high cash value policies that people are going to access the loans, we have rates at 5.82 and 7%. Those are the two biggest ones that I can think of that come to mind. While the dividend rates on one of them is 6.4 and the other one is 5.75. So there is potentially a small opportunity for some arbitrage in one of them and quite a bit of negative arbitrage in the other one. Not really an advantage, I think, over time, because you will see that shift. Sometimes it'll be higher. Sometimes that loan rate will be higher than the dividend rate. Sometimes it'll be lower than the dividend rate. The dividend rate is a gross number anyways. Nobody sees that actual number come out of their policy because there's expenses and other things that come out of a policy. So the opportunity for arbitrage inside of whole life, even with a non-direct recognition policy or a non-direct recognition loan, the opportunity for arbitrage just really isn't there consistently. That's why I don't really have a preference for non-direct recognition either, much like you. Now, I own policies that are direct recognition and non-direct recognition. My very large policies are non-direct, or my very large policies are direct recognition. And the reason I chose direct recognition, knowing it will affect the dividend rate, is because the loan rate is not variable. For me, if I have large dollars amounts and I'm planning on borrowing those out to do other investments, to do my infinite banking or bank on yourself, it seems more valuable to me to know what my cost will be for that loan interest, as opposed to having it be 5% 1 year and 7% another year. That could be a massive swing and cause chaos, unpredictability in the profitability of whatever I'm doing in conjunction with my policy.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why I don't have a strong opinion on it. I happen to just want to put in large amounts of money over a long period of time into my whole life policy. And the carrier that has great performance as well, that I chose and landed on, it had all those things, and it happens to be direct recognition. And so it's not an issue to me. But to pivot back just slightly to some of the things as well, when we're talking about these direct recognition, the consideration is, if it is a low interest rate environment, whole life carriers can hold dividends up, and they have. They have a history in near zero interest rate environments of still paying gross dividend rates in that 5 and 6% range because they have long-term assets in that portfolio. So in these really low interest rate environments, that is where you might see an opportunity for some of that arbitrage within the policy. But in a direct recognition policy, that same time period, we have access to what we might call an I-block or insurance-backed line of credit or some other terms for that. So we have access to the same concept if we want to access that. We can get line of credit where we collateralize our policy. And that is something that, because whole life is a very secure asset, we have the ability to, at that point, turn a direct recognition policy sort of into a non-direct recognition policy.
Just to be clear, we're collateralizing it with an outside bank, an outside institution. That's what the I-block is. You can combine policies. So there are ways that, in a favorable interest rate environment, and I did this with a few of my policies, I combined them when the interest rate was really low, and these would otherwise be direct recognition, and I was able to take advantage of that low interest rate environment that we were in. So another point on the direct recognition side, if I were to make an argument for one or the other, but in general, my preference is to own multiple policies and have different types. I do that myself. And when I need loans from a policy, I just go to whichever one has the best terms first. It's as simple as that. Now, a lot of people may not have multiple policies, so it's a good idea to understand the differences and at least start off with whichever one makes you the most comfortable.
And I operate the same way. I have two large policies, and it sometimes I'm actually considering right now possibly taking a loan from one to pay off the other because there's just slightly different rates. So it might make sense to go ahead and do that rather than liquidating assets elsewhere. So I think that's the beauty of these things, is we don't have to make these choices to liquidate assets. One thing I don't think is always clear, especially for folks who are in the non-direct recognition only camp, sometimes it wasn't clear to me when I started getting into this at first. It is not that you lose your dividend. I thought at one point that direct recognition meant you either are, it's either you don't pay with non-direct, you pay, there's no impact, so you're not paying anything. But where you have direct recognition, you completely use your dividend. That is not the case. You still get some type of dividend with the carriers that we use. I don't know of any that gives you, eliminates entirely, and actually there is that guaranteed growth as well. So there's something there, but what they do is there might be some kind of offset or what might be a wash, so they adjust it down or up. And in there are cases where direct recognition, you might even be actually earning more inside your policy because they turn it into a wash and you're paying more. So there are those circumstances as well.
Yeah, sometimes there are very rare circumstances, but in a direct recognition policy, you might earn more from the offsetting of that loan than the dividend rate would have been. Doesn't happen very often, but I think that was the point you're trying to make.
Exactly.
Okay, the final thing I think to mention about loans before we move on to the flexibility of these products is, how does that loan interest work? The loan interest on cash value life insurance is much like any other line of credit out there. It's going to be a simple interest. It's calculated and you get billed once a year on however much money you had for however long you had it throughout the year. And there's no minimum payment requirements. You don't have to make a payment on it. They will send you a bill for the interest. You don't even necessarily have to pay that as long as it doesn't lapse your policy. So there's a lot of flexibility with regard to loan repayments. You can do it on your schedule. It's one of the reasons we love these things for doing bank on yourself and infinite banking. It's hard to beat that.
Yeah, there's really not anything that exists in the same way. With a HELOC, for example, you're still going to have, every time you draw from it, you're going to have some kind of minimum payment. So if for whatever reason you just don't have the ability to pay back a loan for a given period of time, you can just let it sit and it will eventually, if you've never paid off, it will be deducted from your death benefit. So it is annual simple interest. Each year, that loan interest will get tacked onto that balance. And so if you do that long enough and you didn't have enough cash in there, it is possible this could cause a lapse. So that is a consideration. But generally speaking, in this space, we want to practice good financial habits. So it is a good idea to try to pay off that loan interest every year if you can.
Well said. All right, let's talk about flexibility of these products. What do you see? We can't really talk exact specifics because there's so much flexibility between a lot of the different products. But at its base level, what is the one thing that you have to do every single year with a whole life policy?
You have to make that minimum premium payment. That is the core level of it. Whole life has that set cost. Now, there's different things that you can do. There is the concept of reduced paid up, but that's for another day. With a whole life policy, when you have it in force and you're still having premium payments, you will have to make that minimum premium payment and cover the kind of base level of expenses in that whole life policy.
Yeah, I like to say it's the base premium. You always have to make that base premium payment, which is the whole life portion of a whole life policy. We deal with a lot of blended designs, which blends in some supplemental term insurance, and it gives us the ability to buy a lot of paid up additions, but you still have to pay that base. And there are a lot of different designs out there. You could have a policy that's all base, in which case you have to pay all of it. There is no minimum amount. You just have to make that payment that was scheduled. Otherwise, your policy could lapse. So there could be some designs that are not very flexible with regard to what you have to pay into it. But then we have our special designs that we like to do that helps contribute to the high cash value designs for the policies that we like to sell. How do we do that?
So we blend in term life insurance. And what that gives us access to is the ability to put in large amounts of money with minimal amounts of base premium. And generally speaking, the way that we design policies, we're targeting somewhere in the 20% base or 10% base, and then the rest is that paid up additions payment. And so what that gives you is, and let's just say you had $10,000 of total premium, maybe that base premium and minimum requirement might be in that $1,000 or $1,500 or $2,000 range. And that's the minimum that you definitely have to meet. And then the rest can be flexible, just depending on the carrier. There's different rules on different carriers and how and when you can get those premiums paid in, or those paid up additions paid in. Some have catch-up provisions, some don't, and some are less flexible. But But generally speaking, if you run into a situation where you are not in this the same financial position as when you opened it, by having these specially designed policies, you are going to have significantly more flexibility than with some of these all-based policies.
Yeah, they can be very flexible. There are major differences between the carriers on what they will allow as far as flexibility throughout the current year, when you can make those extra payments, how you treat your policy may cause you to lose the ability to retain that flexibility. So we can't, it's going to be impossible for us to get into all those specific details on this podcast, but we may end up touching on it throughout the years as we continue to talk about this stuff when we talk about any particular carrier. Just know there is flexibility, a lot of flexibility with some carriers, less flexibility with others, and probably no flexibility with some of them as well. So if that's important to you, make sure you get with an agent that understands these things. What do you have for a call to action for our folks this week?
It's time for this week's call to action.
If you're interested in whole life, which I think is great, I think everybody it can serve a place in most people's asset portfolios, determining what level of flexibility you have for those premium payments and what loan structures you need. Those are the things that are going to help us. If you're going to schedule something, some time with one of us, then those are the things that are going to help us guide you to what the best product is. So assess that. You know, if you think you're targeting 10 grand a year and you know it's solid, maybe the flexibility isn't as important, and then we can guide you in the correct direction. So try to assess that for your situation and book a meeting with one of us.
Yeah, on the flip side, maybe they want to fund $100,000, and that might be very aggressive. So you want the flexibility that if you need to, you can cut that way down. So I'm right there with you. I think flexibility is most of the time the number one factor in determining which product may fit the client's current financial situation best. Then we look at loans. What's the different loan types? How are they planning on using it? The tax advantages are basically the same among all of these things. So that's not really a deciding factor. Make sure if you're in the market for a whole life policy that you talk to agents that understand these differences and can help you decide which one may end up helping you best meet those needs. We're obviously a source for that. Reach out to us if you can. Reach out to us if it makes sense and you need some advice. We're happy to do that. And with that, we're going to wrap this up. Although next week, we're going to be talking about IUL specifically and how IUL stacks up versus all kinds of other financial products. Be sure to come back for that. Signing off this week, I'm James Barber, your Oregon cash flow pro, and I'm licensed for life insurance and annuities across the country.
And my name is Carlo Vaquera. You can find me at netwealthfinance.com. or at Net Wealth Finance on YouTube. And we'll work with clients across the country as well.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for watching.